The lives of thousands of Americans hang in the balance tonight in Afghanistan. U.S. citizens and the Afghans who helped them have been told by America's top military leaders, if you want to get out of the country, find your own way to the airport through a gauntlet of Taliban.
His State Department, as you know, as I've said, is working with the Taliban to facilitate safe passage of American citizens, U.S. passport holders, to the airport. That's the primary means, and under the current conditions, that's the primary effort.
Dear God, is America really leaving it up to the Taliban to decide who gets to leave and who might die tonight on Banfield? Get to the airport on your own. That is the only way to survive for thousands and thousands of Americans scattered throughout Kabul and across Afghanistan tonight. Hamid Karzai International Airport is the only way out of that country, and it is a treacherous gauntlet to get there. It's filled with beatings and whippings and shootings and death at Taliban checkpoints. Kabul is the capital and the largest urban center in Afghanistan, and it is fully under Taliban control, but for that airport. U.S. embassy staff have already been evacuated to that airport, mostly by helicopter. And the Afghan presidential palace and offices have all been seized. They're gone. The only bright spot for Americans in that country, that airport, 3 miles from the city center. It is defended by thousands of American troops, but it is ringed with Taliban, who have RPGs and guns and truncheons and whips, and they're using them. Today, America's top military leaders were asked about that treacherous journey to the airport. It's through Taliban-filled streets. And their only answer was that they've made an agreement with the Taliban, an agreement to facilitate Americans' safe passage, but just Americans, those with American passports and documents. In other words, they made a deal with the devil, and they are hoping to hell that the devil keeps its word at every single dark street corner. And speaking of that deal, we are seeing images like this of Taliban fighters carrying RPGs and terrorizing people on the street. Maybe the ones being terrorized aren't American citizens with those fancy documents and passports. But what about the 50 to 65,000 Afghans who have worked tirelessly and dedicated themselves to the safety of Americans and helped them through 20 long years of conflict? That is an excellent question, isn't it? Especially for the United States president.
Because we've got like 10 to 15,000 Americans in the country right now, right? And are you committed to making sure that the troops stay until every American who wants to be out is out?
Yes.
How about our Afghan allies? We have about 80,000 people.
Well, that's not the
estimate. Is that too high?
That's too high.
How many?
The estimate we're giving is somewhere between 50 and 65,000 folks total, counting their families.
Does the commitment hold for them as well?
The commitment holds to get everyone out that, in fact, we can get out and everyone should come out.
George Stephanopoulos' interview with the president today. Joining me now, Matt Zeller is an Afghanistan combat veteran and the co-founder of the organization No One Left Behind, dedicated to getting people out of war zones, people just like those Afghans. And Colonel Christopher Kalenda was the first American to fight the Taliban as a commander in combat. He has also negotiated with them. His forthcoming book is called Zero Sum Victory: What We're Getting Wrong About War. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with me tonight. Matt, I want to begin with you. The situation continues to fall apart, it seems, hour by hour. In fact, speaking of just the last hour, I want to show you a video that I just obtained exclusively of what it looks like right outside the airport. It was at dawn, which is right about now. These were Afghans who were huddled outside the airport. You'll see how terrified they are just to run pictures. But watch what happens as Taliban soldiers come by them. And there are children in this group.
Bu olsun.
the whippings and the beatings that we've been talking about are real. They're happening and they are being captured on video. Imagine the numbers that aren't being captured on video. And the Americans are telling Americans and others, just try to get through it. Will they be able to?
No, because beyond those beatings are Taliban checkpoints where they are stopping people, taking their passports, taking their green cards. They're taking any phones that have English words on them, any documents that are in English. Look, they're liars. They're thugs. I don't know why he considers to think that he can continue to negotiate with these people. But if he is, the deal he needs to make is this. They're thugs. We're the United States of America. It's time to start acting like it. We're going to take all of our people everywhere in Afghanistan. Enough of this. And we're going to do it by force. We have the might. We should use it for such. Those beatings, I've been hearing about them for days now. You're the first one to actually show me ones in the daylight. I've seen them on darkness. I've had people call me on the phone while they're being beaten. It's atrocious. What I can't imagine what it must be like to be one of the United States Marines, the United States Army soldiers on post right now and not be able to shoot those people. Because what they're committing right now is atrocities. This is disgusting.
And by the way, this is within feet, right? It's within feet of the American soldiers.
Within literally 50 meters. The thing that's probably the most frustrating about this is that, you know, the nightmare scenario was what Trump would have done was just abandon these people entirely. But next to that, this is it. This is what we feared the most, which was a total collapse and then a chaotic exit from one airfield. We have to expand that perimeter. We have to set up a humanitarian corridor and start guaranteeing people safe passage. You know, the French have their special forces going out and getting people. Other allied nations are having people rallying at certain points in the city and then having their troops go out and meet them there and escort them safely to the airport. There's such much more of an efficient way to do this. It's they need to get a hold of the situation because the Taliban are testing us. They're trying to see what they can get away with. And if we continue to allow them to do this, eventually they're going to just start shooting people. They're not going to just beat them. They're going to start killing them in front of us. We have to stop this now before it gets out of hand. And then, oh, it's just awful.
It is. Colonel Kalenda, what Matt says makes sense, but for this is Taliban-controlled Kabul, and all the Americans control right now is that small piece of real estate in the airport. Is it possible to expand the perimeter? Is it possible to set up safe corridors for those who need to get to the airport, at times just half a mile, maybe even less, but can't? Is there any strategic way for the Americans to get to the desperate people in hiding?
Well, I think so. It's I'm working right now with a lot of my former interpreters. People have put their lives on the line for me and for my soldiers to get them, to help get them passage, get their SIVs in. The process has been way too bureaucratic and get them to Kabul. Now, I've had people who traveled from Kunar and Nuristan out in the east. I know of people who've traveled from the south and they've made it to the airport. And they don't report any harassment along the way. So I think you've got a lot of mixed reports here. At the same time, the way that this has unfolded and how we've just gotten our pants caught with our pants at half mast on this is not acceptable. But we got to play the hand that we're dealt. All you get from wagon, pointing fingers is a lot of tired fingers. And what we need to do now is figure out how do we get our people out safely? How do we help Afghans, SIV applicants and refugees out safely? How do we help Afghans address the humanitarian crisis that's going on? There are over 20 million Afghans facing an acute humanitarian crisis. And then how do we work with Afghan authorities on the ground to prevent terrorism from coming into Afghanistan? So we've got a choice now. We can turn our backs on Afghanistan like what happened in the 80s and we see what happened, or we can figure out ways to work together with Afghans to try to deal with these four main challenges.
All right. So, Matt, you have some pictures that I saw earlier today, and I found them so distressing. They were pictures, I think, of a cousin of yours outside of Hamid Karzai Airport. And The pictures show people passing their children and their babies to the front of the line, hoping that they will perhaps make it in and over the barricades. Can you give me any more information about these pictures?
Yeah, it's exactly what you're seeing there, passing children bucket brigade style up to the front, hoping it could convince the U.S. soldiers at the gate to start letting some people through, at least the kids, because they're that desperate to get away from these people. You know, the colonel is right. Everything that he said is spot on. We have a choice to make. We can get all these people out now. I would argue we actually should go into other airfields around the country. We should make a deal with the Taliban. We're going to take everybody. They don't want to fight us. They just want their country. So let's tell them they can have their country in exchange for all of our people. Because if we don't take every single one of them, we know what's already going on in other cities. There's the videos that you aren't showing are of the public executions that are currently going on at the stadium in Kandahar, or the mass graves that they're digging outside of the city of Kandahar, where they're just throwing people into the ditches and then shooting them in sight. There are protests that are breaking out in some Afghan cities where brave Afghans are displaying the true Afghan flag. Because let's remember this, the Taliban are not the legitimate government. They just overthrew the democratically elected government. And so the people who are brave enough to display that flag are being shot on sight. These people are evil. And so we have an obligation to get as many of them out as we possibly can. There are a number of airfields that we could immediately secure. If we're going to make a deal, that should be the deal that should be made. If not, we can take them by force. I know that's controversial, but what other means do we have at this point? We didn't plan this properly. We tried to warn them. I'm not trying to point fingers, but my goodness, now that we have the opportunity to do this, let's just go in and commit it all the way, because if we don't, we're going to fail to get it right, and then we're going to pay the consequences. The videos that are going to come out are going to be of mass murder. It's going to be of crimes against humanity. We have a chance to stop some of that now. We should.
Chris Kalenda, there are a couple of things that were said by the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when they held a joint news conference earlier today. I heard highly dynamic environment mentioned several times. I have original sourced information from today. In the airport, Marines saying that the situation currently may not be the same situation in 24 hours. And advice has been going out to some Americans, get here now, risk what it takes to get through that gauntlet, because if we lose Karzai Airport, there's no guarantees for anyone anymore. That is entirely different than what we heard from the president and what we heard from the Pentagon. But what can be done short of taking Bagram again, which they waffled on, short of putting in spec ops to go out and do extractions, which they waffled on? Colonel, what can be done to rescue these people?
Well, I think, first of all, I spent a lot of time in combat. And one of the things that I learned is treat with extreme skepticism the most outrageous reports, the most, you know, sort of alarming reports, and also the most optimistic reports. And, you know, Saddam Hussein, who is the head of Tolo TV in Afghanistan, I mean, he had all of his people go back to work. He stayed in Afghanistan, unlike some of the Afghan leaders who took the money and ran. He stayed in Afghanistan. He's got his women reporters on the case. You know, a woman anchor was interviewing a Taliban official just yesterday. And what Saddam Hussein said is, you know, we're going to get a lot of alarming reports, unverified reports. We ought to qualify them with unverified. You know, to the extent that they're not yet verified. There's a lot of fake news and misinformation going on about Afghanistan, and it's not helping the situation to inflame it. Now, in terms of, you know, Matt's exactly right. In terms of getting folks out, the Taliban want us to leave. They want the people who want to leave the country to leave. They've said this publicly. They are, you know, they seem to be following through with that. And if there are ways to work with them to secure other places in other airports where people could just get on planes and, you know, and be able to go, then we ought to do that. You know, you can, you know, there are ways to make this go more smoothly and ways that help us alleviate a lot of the suffering that's going on in Afghanistan. And then there are ways to make it worse. And I hope we do the former.
When we come back after the break, I want to ask you about something that I noticed profoundly today. Question after question after question, gentlemen, was I hear you about the U.S. passports and the U.S. documents and that you've made a deal with the Taliban to let the Americans through. But never once did anyone say that men like this are going to let Afghans through. And quite the opposite. On the street, we're hearing if they're Afghan, they should be staying. That's the word from the Taliban. So how might we get those up to 60,000 Afghans out? That's next. Welcome back to our special coverage of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, with 10 to 15,000 Americans still stranded in that country tonight. There are another 50 to 65,000 Afghan citizens who helped the U.S. during that conflict, and they're in the same situation. Today, America's top military leaders and those said that those Americans and the allies will not be extracted to get to the airport. They will not be collected to bring them to the airport, but instead they have to find their own way through the streets of Kabul, past the Taliban checkpoints, and get to the airport if they hope to make it out. Not sure if that's a reasonable amount of pressure and danger to put on innocent civilians, but still with me, Matt Zeller, an Afghanistan combat veteran and co-founder of the organization No One Left Behind, and Colonel Christopher Kalenda, the first American to fight the Taliban as a commander in combat, also negotiated with the Taliban. So, Matt Zeller, it was profound to hear question after question answered with, yes, Americans with documents will get through the Taliban checkpoints. We've made an agreement with them. The State Department is negotiating with the Taliban. But not one time did they say any Afghans would get through. Do you think the Afghans are destined to be stuck there and potentially slaughtered?
No, because we can decide to take them. This hasn't happened yet. I keep saying over and over again, this is a never again moment in the making. Look, the train is crashing. It's derailing. It's already hitting the village. We can still evacuate some of the village. We have to get them out now. We can't stop the train from coming off the tracks, but we can still get some of these people out of the village. We just have to choose to do it. We can just summon the courage and conviction to do the right thing. I know we can. The problem is it seems to be, is that thus far we don't have the political will. I've been told over and over again by people I'm talking to all throughout Congress, throughout the coalition. You have to understand there's an army of people in the United States from all walks of life, veterans, faith-based organizations, human rights organizations. No. I'm sorry, I'm tired. I've gotten maybe 14 hours of sleep in the last 96 because we're all fighting this digital Dunkirk. But we're not doing media hits. I'm literally trying to help people get through the gate at Kabul Airport. I still have family there that I'm trying to get out. This is deeply personal because it's not a matter of us versus them. It's just a matter of us. These are our people. We have to take them. There is no other option. It would be akin to leaving an American soldier behind. I don't understand why our government doesn't see that. Why do they care where they placed in the birth lottery? Why do they care about where they were born? Why don't they care about what they did in their life? These people stood next to us. People like me looked them in the eye and said America would be them for in their time of need. If we don't get this right, I fear for the world that my daughter is going to have to grow up in. I don't want her to have to grow up in a world where the United States of America is seen to not keep its word. And I got to tell you something. I wish that somebody in the president's team would read the after-action report from Vietnam, because what they said is exactly what is happening now. They said, don't try and triage the situation at the airport. You need to just simply load people onto planes and then figure out their status later. That's what we should have done in Vietnam. They did it in the last 72 hours, and that's why they were able to get a lot of people out. By the way, they didn't fly them out. They got them out in boats. That famous image of the helicopter coming off of the embassy in Saigon, it's actually not the embassy. It was the CIA station, but a lot of people get it wrong. That helicopter didn't fly to the airport. The airport had already been overrun at that point. It flew to an aircraft carrier at sea. We got most of the people out in Vietnam because we had an ocean and boats to work with. That's why we've been saying for months that this is going to take the largest airlift since Berlin. We can get these people out. We have the capabilities. We should be getting them just simply onto planes. The after-action report from Vietnam made it very clear. They should hand authority over this to the DOD. Let DOD put people on planes and let State Department figure out what to do with them once we get them to a place like Qatar.
Matt, the difference being, though, that Saigon was rimmed with the North Vietnamese, and they paused for weeks and allowed those people to get through Saigon to that CIA station for rescue. Right now, Kabul is replete with these Taliban soldiers who are beating, whipping, and killing people. So, Colonel Kalenda, I watched as well as the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were questioned by the press corps saying, what about special operations? What about extractions? And they waffled. They really wouldn't answer, which I actually felt was good because it might mean that that might happen, that they might actually use spec ops to go and find people in hiding, Americans and Afghans as well, even though they have been prioritized second on the list. But do you think it's possible with spec ops to get that many people when the Pentagon said we just can't do it on a mass scale?
Well, there are a lot of options here to deal with this situation. The first and foremost is we just need to get people out of the country, stop triaging people in Kabul, get them to Doha, for instance, where you can process these applications and these applications for SIVs.
But you can't get them anywhere till they can get to the airport. And I think that's my problem. My problem is you cannot do anything till they make that last mile.
I can only tell you what the interpreters that I am working with who are traveling from places in the east and the south, they've been able to make it to the airport. And so we just need to get people moving from the airport to a place where they can be processed. And the other thing that we've got to do is make things much more permissive. When you've got letters signed by people like me or people like Matt who've worked directly with these individuals, just stop the bureaucracy, stop the foolishness, and move these applications forward. I mean, right now, State Department officials are, they're petrified of being thrown under the bus if they approve an SIV for an Afghan who a couple years later steals a packet of bubble gum. I mean, we have got to be better than this.
I completely agree. Though this is a really key point because, I got into an argument on TV earlier with Stephen Miller, and Stephen Miller is the reason why a lot of these people can't get out because he made Congress include a requirement in the 2015 National Defense Authorization Act. In order to get an additional 4,000 visas, he required that in order to get an SIV, the actual third party that employed these people had to sign what's called a human resources letter, an HR letter. So in addition to the opinion of the colonel and myself, some contractor who sat at Bagram in some conditioned air conditioned office, right, who never met any of these people, got to decide their fates. And most of them were just simply coded as terminated for cause because that was more efficient than actually trying to dig into why they might have had to been let go in a job. I know of people who have these horrible, these letters that say that they abandoned their post. Well, they didn't abandon their post. They were blown up in a hospital. They couldn't get back to their position. And then they're just coded as such. And now they can't get a visa. They actually have a name for themselves. They call themselves the blacklisted. Those people should not have any say in this whatsoever. All that should matter would be the opinion of people like the colonel and myself who stood next to these people. And if we're saying, hey, they're good enough to get here, get them on an airplane, please. And you know what? We don't even have
I'll tell you.
We have a biometrics database. We put all these people through that database. We should simply just use the technology that we have to verify who these people are. We already have all their addresses and their thumbprints. We can just process them that way, get them on planes, and get them out of the country.
Matt, I'm with you. And the Digital Dunkirk, I'm part of it because I also have friends there and am trying hard to help them as well. And I keep hearing the same thing. They're terrified to hit the streets. They are absolutely terrified of the gauntlet that they have to go through. And they're being told still at times to shelter in place. I have to leave it there. Colonel Christopher Kalenda, thank you. And Matt Zeller, thank you. I hope we can speak again as this crisis continues. When we come back after the break, I spent a fair bit of time in Kabul, and it is not an easy place to navigate when the Taliban aren't there. But it is a brutal place to navigate right now. It has just become daylight in Kabul right now, and the whippings are already starting. When we come back, two seasoned and veteran journalists who also know their way around that city with their thoughts on how the hell these people are going to make that last mile to the airport to safety. Welcome back to our continuing breaking coverage of the chaos in Afghanistan. Just imagine you're an American citizen stranded in that country and you're told, just get yourself through the streets of Kabul to the airport where it's safe. The soldiers are here. Just, you know, make it through the Taliban gauntlet. You might make it to the city of Kabul if you're out in the other outlying parts of Afghanistan. But what about the last few deadly miles, even the last few deadly yards? Around every corner, a Taliban soldier could be standing with an assault rifle, an RPG, maybe a truncheon, maybe a whip. Would you be able to make that trip with your children? One person who did not have to make that journey is the now former president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani. He reportedly left the country just a couple of days ago, but he had a nice helicopter, and apparently he had four beautiful cars that he took with him, and those cars were stuffed with cash. And if you're wondering how much cash, the reports have it at $169 million U.S. The Russians actually said he wanted to take so much cash it couldn't fit, so he had to leave some behind on the tarmac. That's how he got out. But everybody else is sheltering in place, terrified of what might be ahead on the streets just to get to the safe place, the airport. To discuss what we have on our hands right now, two people who know more about Afghanistan than almost anyone. David Loin is a journalist who's been covering Afghanistan since 1996, when the Taliban first took control of Kabul. He was also a former advisor to the office of Afghanistan's president, Ashraf Ghani. Some say he knows every grain of sand in Afghanistan. In fact, his forthcoming book is entitled The Long War. I'm also joined by Sebastian Younger. He spent 15 months in Afghanistan. He walked those Kabul streets, and he knows what it will take to navigate to the airport. His latest book is entitled Freedom. Gentlemen, thank you and welcome. Sebastian Younger, I know you've been looking at the pictures that we've been looking at, desperate people racing and charging onto the runway to just run up the back of a C-17 and sit on the floor and take the flight wherever it goes. But there are still those who are hunkering down in safe houses, and they're sheltering in place because that's what the Americans told them to do. And now they don't know how to get past the Afghan checkpoints. What's your assessment of the situation in Kabul?
Well, you know, I know what you know. It looks terrifying. It reminds me of scenes from many countries that have fell into chaos. I mean, the truth is that it's now the Taliban's country, and they are in charge of security. And I know that it looks daunting, but it's not clear what their rules are for who gets to pass and who doesn't. And I think until we know what criteria they're using, it's hard to judge how easily or with how much difficulty people will be able to make their way to the airport. I'm guessing that people with American passports, I mean, the Taliban do not, at this point, I'm guessing they do not want a fight with America. They haven't attacked U.S. forces since February of 2020. So clearly they're not looking for a fight. I don't know why they would start one now by detaining or killing American citizens. But who knows? Like, there's just no way to know what will happen in this volatile situation.
Yeah, the pictures you're seeing on your screen were just brand new pictures of a situation just a couple days ago where there was a full charge to the runways. And these Apache helicopters had to actually, you know, scale runways to clear people off of the runways so that the C-17s could take off. And then, of course, that awful scene of those people clinging to the C-17s took place right after. But these are some of the more recent videos that are starting to come in of that situation on the runway. So, David Loin, can you describe for our viewers who may never have been to Kabul and don't know what it's like in that city, what the close quarters are like and what it's like to go through a checkpoint? I think you and I have both gone through Taliban checkpoints. I've gone through checkpoints with Afghan soldiers, and they're sometimes 14 years old and hopped up on heroin. But maybe just describe what that situation's like, because people watching might just think, just go. It's just a checkpoint. Just go to the airport and get your airplane.
Yeah, Ashley, I mean, you paint the picture really well. It's great to be on your show, by the way. And I think that, you know, for people in Kabul now who want to leave, and I've obviously been in touch with a lot of people I know, in both working in the government, people who I've worked with as translators, interpreters over the years, that I've been traveling in Afghanistan, it is a really frightening challenge, particularly those with children. And I think some of the problems are that the Taliban are not an entirely united movement. We've heard a lot of reports of Taliban who are speaking languages that are not from Pakistan or Afghanistan. There are a lot of Punjabis among the Taliban who are Pakistani, speaking Punjabi and Urdu. But there are Chechens, clearly. There are Arabs. So there are plenty of those young men in the streets with beards carrying Kalashnikovs who are not necessarily even Afghan and not necessarily under the command of the very emollient Taliban who we've seen doing press conferences in the last few days, telling the international community everything's going to be fine, and trying to satisfy the outside world that this is going to be a movement that the international community should recognize. It really mattered to the Taliban that the international community didn't recognize their regime when they were in power in the late 1990s. They used to say to me in Kabul or Kandahar, what's the problem? Why aren't they? And I think this time it's going to be really important for their government on the top level to say we're moderate, we're different. But what we're seeing in the streets of people being arrested summarily, bodies in the streets of Kandahar in the south, people who've worked with the international community taken out of their homes and shot, young women being taken from their homes by young Taliban fighters as sex slaves, effectively. They call them wives, which is just appalling behavior. So I think there are very much two ends of this. And for people in Kabul, a city that, the other thing I would say significantly, a city that's changed enormously over the last 20 years. Believe it or not, when the Taliban came in 1996, I was with them exactly 25 years ago next month into Kabul, there was a kind of relief. They had some consent because they came in off the back of a terrible civil war and the city had been destroyed by that civil war. Well, Kabul has now been built. Kabul Airport, that we're seeing pictures of, completely rebuilt since 2001. Huge new buildings, shopping malls across the city, new schools, new kind of way of life for a new generation. The intervention that we've been involved in over the last 20 years wasn't all wasted. And that's, of course, one of the real tragedies of what we're seeing in these pictures now, of the Taliban coming in and taking the whole thing over with real fear. And this time, they do not govern with the same kind of consent that they had in the mid-1990s.
You are right. And I'm just going to give a quick warning to anyone who's watching now. I'm going to put a photograph on the screen that is extraordinarily difficult to watch. It's very graphic. It involves injured children. But I think it speaks to what my former guest said, that lots of people are getting to the airport. Lots of people aren't either. This is from the Los Angeles Times. This shows, I believe, a woman who has been beaten on the ground and a child in the arms of someone who's covered in blood and another child in the background on the right who's covered in blood. This is the situation if you want to try to get to the airport. It is a catastrophe for anyone who is trying to get those last quarter, half, or three quarters of a mile from Kabul, wherever they are in their safe houses, to get to the airport, to get to safety. Gentlemen, I thank you very much for all your reporting and also for your wisdom tonight. And thank you for being my guest. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to switch gears because there is another story that we have been covering for several weeks that just took a very deep and dark turn, a serious development in the criminal investigation involving Jeffrey Epstein and his friends. Prince Andrew, the son of Queen Elizabeth, has officially become a person of interest. United States prosecutors want to talk to the Duke of York, and it's getting really official. We're going to break it down next. You know, it's really not often you hear the terms person of interest and prince in the same sentence. But on top of the civil lawsuit alleging sexual abuse against Prince Andrew, United States prosecutors are now looking to interview the Duke of York in connection with a criminal probe. That probe is the one involving Ghislaine Maxwell and the late Jeffrey Epstein. And if you're wondering how the Queen is handling all of this interest in her favorite son, she's not doing well. because she has politely asked the British press to bugger off, in so many words, warning them not to take any pictures of Andrew or any of her guests at Balmoral, their royal estate in Scotland, during this summer get-together. That's an annual. Joining us to break this all down is Royal Watcher Hilary Fordich. Also with us, Prosecutor Stacey Honowitz, who specializes in sex crimes and child abuse, and legal expert and former prosecutor Susan Phelan. Thank you to all three of you. As the prosecutor in the group, Stacey, I'm going to begin with you. When you're named a person of interest, it gets real, doesn't it?
Well, I think we've been hearing about this for a very long time. We've heard the connections. We've seen the photographs of Epstein with the prince. We've all seen that famous photograph with his arm around the victim, the alleged victim in this case. We've seen him walking with Epstein in the park. So we've always had this air, excuse the terminology, that he was involved somehow. So now it is getting very serious. This lawsuit was filed because the statute of limitations was getting ready to run. And now there is a reopening of the investigation, not only by U.S. prosecutors, but it's my understanding that even over the British prosecutors in the Crown are reopening and taking a look to see what kind of involvement we had, if in fact there was a sexual battery charge to be filed against him.
So, Susan Phelan, when prosecutors say officially now Prince Andrew is a person of interest, we already know that they've been asking for interviews. We already know that they've been rebuffed and that they're getting gaslit by the Crown. Effectively, I think the institution keeps saying, no, we're available. He's always been available. But I'll tell you exactly what the prosecutors said in 2020. They say that Andrew sought to falsely portray himself to the public as eager and willing to cooperate, but had given no interview to federal authorities and repeatedly declined requests to talk to investigators. So does this naming him as a person of interest change that dynamic at all?
I don't think so. I think person of interest means somebody that they want to interview. I don't think it necessarily means suspect in a criminal way yet. And I think that what the prince is saying is we've made ourselves available on three separate occasions and you haven't taken us up on it, which is kind of a cool sleight of hand because it makes it look like perhaps the U.S. prosecutors dropped the ball and didn't make it happen. But I think these are all pretty much games. He doesn't have to cooperate and he doesn't have to speak with U.S. prosecutors. U.S. prosecutors want to speak to him. The real linchpin to me here is what is Maxwell going to do? Is she going to cooperate? Because she certainly would have a great deal of information on what actually happened if she does come forward and she is truthful.
So, Hilary Fordich, that's a good moment to turn to you because Glenn Maxwell is also a British citizen. She's also, I believe, an Israeli citizen and a U.S. citizen, but there's that British connection
French.
As well. And French as well, right. She was arrested with apparently a lot of passports in that hideaway house that that they found her in. So I guess this is a two-pronged question for you. Across the pond, what are the prosecutors there doing to help U.S. prosecutors, if anything, with regard to this criminal probe where he's now being named a person of interest? And the Queen must be devastated, however you nuance person of interest.
Yes, on a couple of points there, and pleasure to be back with you again, Ashley. Yes, it was at the Ghislaine's house in New Hampshire where she was found with multiple passports, and that's why she was deemed a high flight risk. With regard to your question about the British prosecutors, Dame Cressida Dix, she's the head of the Metropolitan Police, has said that they will reopen a review of the case. One has to wonder, though, in all these years, every single movement of any member of the royal family, obviously they have a advanced teams. They have security teams. Everything is documented. Everything is kept in separate files. Why no one has come forward? No one has ever come forward to say anything of any sort that they actually saw anything happen. Whereas in the United States here, we have the three people. John Brockman, the literary agent, has said that he saw a Russian model giving Prince Andrew foot massages. And Steve Scully, who worked on one of Jeffrey Epstein's estates, has said that he saw bikini clad young girls giving massages. And of course, the housekeeper in Palm Beach has said the similar thing. But one wonders why none of this has come forward in the British Isles at all. And then to your last point about the Queen, of course, she's devastated. This is her, one of her sons, like any parent would be about their child. To your point, though, earlier, with regard to that statement that came out from Buckingham Palace, it's issued from the palace, but for privacy at Balmoral, the royal family's been going to Balmoral since 1849. Of course, Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, bought the property then, and every single year when they holiday there in August at this time, the similar statement comes out. It was the timing that was rather ghastly this year, and that's why the two have been linked.
And the timing being that it was just a day prior to the prince's arrival, which I think is correct. Why everybody said, yikes, that's awfully embarrassing. But ladies, stay put, if you will, when we come back after the break. You know, Susan, you mentioned it. You hinted, what will Ghislaine Maxwell say? Because honestly, if she wants to sing like a canary, she might do herself some justice. But what will that mean for the prince? That's coming up next. Now with Royal Watcher Hillary Fordich and legal experts Stacey Honowitz and Susan Filan. So, Stacey, Susan mentioned in the last block the business about Ghislaine Maxwell and will she talk? I can only imagine that she's going to say something. And I can only imagine that once she does say something, and if it involves the prince, it does change the metric. Would it?
Yeah, but I don't think she's going to say anything. She's been in custody for a very long time. We've had this notion about the prince being involved. Like I said, we've seen these pictures before, and she hasn't said anything. She hasn't made any statement about him. And quite frankly, if she does make a statement about him, it still implicates her as the one that set this deal up, as she's the one that trafficked, you know, this victim. So will it make a difference for the world to know that the prince was involved somehow or that she was instrumental in this? Yes, but I don't think that it's going to do anything to save her from the charges that she's looking at.
Okay, Susan Filan, just quickly, we've been talking about diplomatic immunity, and in the civil case, maybe not, but if there is an involvement in the criminal case, does he get diplomatic immunity? And I've got about 30 seconds.
I don't know. I think so. But look, these are the questions that people have to research. It's very, very interesting legal issues. But I think it's going to be really hard for the United States to get at this prince for lots of reasons. And I think it's a tough case to prove.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. He's facing conspiracy to entice minors to travel to engage, facing conspiracy to entice minors to travel to engage in illicit sex acts, and then enticement, the same. Then conspiracy to transport minors with intent to engage, and transportation, and then two perjury charges. So those are all extraordinarily serious. I think the plot continues and thickens. Thank you to all three of you. So appreciate it for your time and your expertise. Something tells me that we're going to have you all back in pretty soon. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us tonight on Banfield. We'll see you right back here tomorrow night, 10 o'clock Eastern.